Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Goldratt's Rules of Flow by Efrat Goldratt Ashlog. Read by Perry Daniels. Improving flow is a primary objective of every operation. Dr. Ellie Goldratt, Standing on the Shoulders of Giants, 2008. Introduction. Dr. Ellie Goldratt wrote his first book, The Goal, to introduce his innovative thinking to improve operations. The common belief, he claimed, is that if every machine is fully utilized, the entire operation will be efficient. Thus, managers attempt to maximize the efficiency of each and every machine and work center. That takes a lot of effort, but unfortunately, it doesn't yield the desired result. Instead, managers should look at the whole operation, identify the bottlenecks, and focus only on their productivity. He called it global optimum versus local optimum. Written as an accessible business novel, The Goal became a worldwide bestseller and is known as his introduction to Theory of Constraints, TOC. Although a lot of the key concepts in the TOC application for operations were developed later on, the fundamentals didn't change. In fact, The Goal is as relevant today as it was 35 years ago. Project management is inherently different than production. For one, projects are not as repetitive as production. Every project is different and thus involve a lot more risk. Goldratt noticed that people working in projects make the same basic error. They manage the risk locally instead of looking at the whole picture. They tend to protect every activity, not the complete project, and the way they do it, the safety they incorporate, is bound to be wasted. Goldratt called the new Theory of Constraints application CCPM, Critical Chain Project Management, and to introduce it, he wrote another business novel, Critical Chain. Originally, it included project planning and buffer management. The basic assumption in buffer management is simple. Since projects are late because of unexpected delays, managers should use time buffers to protect against these delays. To protect the whole project, the main buffer should always be placed at the end of the project. With more and more implementations around the world, CCPM proved itself as an excellent technique for managing projects. As the implementations started to accumulate, Goldratt noticed that in too many cases, it wasn't as effective as it ought to be in shortening lead times. At first, he thought it was a matter of deciphering the details. A lot of effort was made by him, as well as many others, to figure out how to stagger tasks, where to place buffers, how to better calculate their size, etc. The results were pretty much the same. Goldratt started to suspect it wasn't about the details. The basic assumption was flawed. Before using buffers, the chaos in projects was so big that all people could do when things went wrong was point fingers at each other. But now, monitoring the buffers provided clarity that no one had before. Goldratt was able to examine the source of disruptions that consumed the buffers, and what he found out was truly eye-opening. The time in projects was wasted not only by unexpected delays, but mainly by inherent obstacles that slow down the flow of projects. That was an astounding revelation. It was no longer about tweaking buffer management. It was about developing a new body of knowledge. The years went by, and Goldratt kept developing the theory of constraints and writing more books while investigating the concept of flow. Whenever he got to talk about his books, he said that one day he'll replace Critical Chain. He'd rewrite it to introduce his new insights. In 2008, he wrote his article, Standing on the Shoulders of Giants, to mark the 25th anniversary of The Goal. This article discusses the origins of focusing on accelerating flow to improve performance in operations. Around that same time, he released the Strategic and Tactical Analysis of Project Management, his most comprehensive work on the subject. Although it was primarily about CCPM, the two major rules of flow, controlling whip and full kit, already played a key role in it. People asked him if the time had finally come to rewrite Critical Chain. His answer was that he was busy writing another book, which he was. He was writing his life philosophy book, The Choice, with me, his daughter. But the real reason was that he felt he wasn't done yet uncovering the rules of flow and ensuring that applying them would, in fact, shorten lead times to an extent that he no longer needed to recommend using buffers for it. He needed a little more time, but he didn't have it. After he passed away in 2011, his work was carried on by the TOC experts at Goldrot Consulting and their affiliates. My father left me in charge of his books, managing the copyrights, special editions, and so forth, with over 30 publishers around the world. After over a decade of highly successful implementations of the rules of flow, and 25 years after Critical Chain was published, I believe the time has come to tend to the book he wished to write, but didn't. When my father wrote The Goal, I was still in elementary school. But since his second business novel, I had the privilege of being part of his inner circle, assisting him in his writing. I am very familiar with his writing style, and I know how he would have liked this new book to be written. It is not a rewrite, but a brand new book that pays homage to the original. Larry Gadd, my father's longtime publisher and editor, offered to edit the book and have it published. Kevin Foster, my colleague and friend, provided valuable insights. But there was an issue. As an organizational psychologist, I live on the borderline between the individual and organizations. But my focus has always been personal success. Even though I have been teaching the thinking processes of the theory of constraints and practicing its application for the individual for years, my background in the application for project management was theoretical. My husband, Dr. Yishai Ashlag, Dr. Ajay Kapoor, and Yossi Reinhartz, stepped in to fill in the blanks. It is thanks to their extensive knowledge, ample experience, and buckets of patience that every single example in this book is based on real-life cases. Dr. Efrat Goldrot Ashlag. 1. The Big Picture. Isaac Wilson, the owner of Wilson Advanced Solutions, is sitting at his desk, staring at the email on his computer screen. Some legal jargon about poor service and breaching agreed-upon terms, with the last line, "We will no longer be using your services." This is a heavy blow. The email is from Doolin, one of their best customers, a large company that has been doing business with them for over 15 years. They had provided some brilliant solutions for Doolin. He didn't think it would come to this. Doolin should have stayed with them. He had read the email again and again. If they could lose Doolin, the writing was on the wall. Isaac is proud of the family company he started over 3 decades ago, but times are changing. Things are not as they used to be, and he is not well. He had gotten the diagnosis a while ago and needs to get his affairs in order. He will not leave his family a sinking ship. Mark exits the gym, his hair still damp from the shower. Glancing at his phone, he notices an unanswered call from his father. He should stop at his office and see what this is about. It's early in the morning, but the sun is already blazing, and Mark is sweating by the time he gets to his SUV. August just started, and it seems like it's going to be a long month. "Good morning, Dad," Mark calls from the door. Isaac raises his eyes. "Come on in." He gestures to the chair across from his desk. "We need to talk." Mark Wilson is 32 years old, tall and athletic. Half the age of his father, but his spitting image in every other way. To Isaac's delight, Mark joined the company right after getting his degree in engineering. He worked his way up to managing their integration and support teams, and a couple of years ago, Isaac put him in charge of his pride and joy, their engineering department. "Did you manage to mend fences with Doolin?" Mark asks. "I'm afraid we've lost them," Isaac says, We delivered too late. Damn. We missed the final due date only by a month or so. Isaac tells himself to calm down. You mean the final due date. The one we pushed for after getting two extensions from the original due date. Then he adds, and it wasn't the first time we missed with them. And there was nothing you could do? Mark persists. We're working on three other projects for them. Isaac sees no point in going into details, although he had gotten an earful from Doolin's president, who had become a friend in their last meeting. We caused them a serious delay getting their new production line operational. They are done with us. Isaac braces himself. This conversation is not going to be easy, no matter how he goes about it. How are we doing with the other projects? Mark doesn't want to commit. We're working as hard as we can. Isaac is not happy with the answer. Are we going to meet the deadlines on the B-120 and the P-831? These projects are for two other large customers, and both are due next month. We'll pick up the pace on them now, Mark replies. We had all hands on deck to help with Doolin's project. Isaac sighs. Rushing to finish projects at the very last minute has become the norm, and they are missing more and more due dates. Isaac knows how hard it is to run the engineering department. He ran it from the beginning, until Mark replaced him. Mark had earned his respect for the innovative ideas he came up with and his ability to steer the other engineers in promising directions. Deep inside, Isaac had been hoping that Mark would also figure out some kind of miracle to manage engineering more efficiently, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Doolin leaving is a hard hit, Isaac presses on, and they are not the first ones to go. The customer's expectations are unrealistic, Mark replies. You know these lead times are too short. Mark, we're already committing to deliver in 6 months instead of five. We can't push the due dates any farther. Mark knows his father is right. Their customers won't tolerate longer lead times. They'll simply go to their competitors. It's not enough time, but they will have to make it work. Got it, he says, even though he has no idea how they can possibly do better. I'm afraid you don't, Isaac replies. We need to look at the big picture here. The big picture? Mark raises an eyebrow. Isaac takes his time before answering. He recalls how he opened the business in the old warehouse at the end of town, using his engineering background and software experience to hook cameras and other sensors to industrial robotic arms. Over the years, they kept at the forefront of the rapidly developing technology and software. The small company earned its reputation by conceptualizing, customizing, producing, and integrating cutting-edge automation solutions. He kept engineering as well as most other departments in town. The production was moved to the southeast a few years back when they opened their second location there. Isaac knows that his son is used to looking at things from the point of view of his department, but he needs to make him see the big picture now. The longer lead times and added employees depleted our margins. Profits are down, and that negatively affects the company's valuation. Our wide customer base and our reputation also have a lot of bearing on the company's value, and both are at risk. With the increasing competition and the large companies taking over the market, we need to face the fact that we are struggling to keep up. Mark is baffled. I'm not sure what else you want me to do. I don't think there is much else you can do, son, Isaac says with a heavy heart. That's why I'm going to start looking for a buyer. 2. Can't miss the due dates. Mark tries to argue, but his father won't hear any of it. He leaves his father's office and passes by Sophia, the office manager who just got in. Sophia is a single mom in her late 40s who has been running his father's office for many years. Usually he would stop to ask her how she and her teenage son are doing. He doesn't mean to be rude, but he is not in the mood to chat now. He is headed to their conference room. He needs room to pace, and his office isn't large enough. Mark is sick to his stomach. What on earth has gotten into his father? He wonders if his sister is in the loop. He should call her. On second thought, he doesn't particularly like talking with his bossy sister. He'll try to deal with their father on his own for now. If he wants a chance to start the discussion with his father again, he can't miss the due date with these two large customers. He texts Abby and Kyle, the engineers in charge of these projects, to meet him. What's up, Mark? Kyle is the first one to join him. Kyle is a bright engineer in his 20s, with excellent management skills. Despite his youth, Mark has been giving him more responsibilities and made him the manager on this important project. We have to meet the due date on the B-120, Mark says, referring to the project Kyle is in charge of. Ask for a new due date, that will give us a few more weeks, and we'll meet it. Kyle doesn't miss a beat. We're not asking for a few more weeks. We need to deliver on time. Well, we're not going to make it. You know it's not our fault. They changed the requirements when we were halfway through. We're going to miss the due date. We can't let that happen. Mark sees Abby at the door and brings the two project managers up to speed. We've lost Doolin. We can't afford to piss off any more customers. Geez, that's bad news, Abby says. The men watch Abby as she picks a chair and joins them. She is short, a bit on the chubby side, with shoulder-length black hair and blue almond-shaped eyes. Abby is their mechanical expert and their most capable project manager. She was in charge of Doolin's projects as well as a few others, including the P-831 they need to deliver pretty soon. I'm sorry, Abby. I know you did everything you could, says Mark. Kyle, looking after his own interests, says, Then give me the people that were working on Doolin's projects. No problem, says Abby, but don't count on them being of much help. They are already swamped with too many other projects, including the P-831. Perhaps we dedicate a couple of them to Kyle? Mark wonders aloud. It's only a few weeks. That will pretty much guarantee we'll be late on the other stuff they're working on, Abby says quietly. We have to get more people. We already tried that a year ago, Mark says. We got more budget and hired good engineers. We increased our staff by 10%, and it didn't seem to make any difference. Mark knows they have to make do with what they've got. They can't hire more people because the numbers won't work. Fine, Kyle shrugs. Let me contact the customer and ask them to cut some features. Here we go again, Mark is thinking. Meeting the due dates, staying on budget, and delivering the full scope, it's the same old thing. Everyone knows that when we start a new project, we aim to get all three of these requirements, but as the project progresses, we end up having to choose. If we want to meet one of these requirements, we end up compromising on one or two of the others. The reality of projects always has been. Only now, he can't afford to compromise on any of them. Listen, we can't risk losing any more customers. We have to do better, whatever it takes. I don't know how much more we can take. Kyle is weary. People already put in a lot of hours. We practically live here. Abby says, We're done here, right? Yeah. I better tell the people to stop working on Doolin's projects, she says as she stands up. Kyle is taking his time. He is burned out, and it's not worth it. The company seems to be struggling, and he doesn't want any stains on his immaculate resume. But he wishes to stay on good terms with the Wilsons. They have been good to him, and he may need references. Mark, can I have a word with you? Kyle says after Abby leaves the room. I've been meaning to talk with you, and it might as well be now. Talk with me about what? The thing is, I've got another offer. One that is too good to pass up. So, please, understand, but I would like to give you my 4 weeks' notice. 3. Re-evaluating. Mark works late most evenings, but it's Friday night and he needs a break. He drives downtown and enters a nice, upscale bar. As he makes his way to an empty stool, he notices there are quite a few good-looking women there. It has been a while since he was involved with someone. A slower look around the room reveals the women are all in tight groups, laughing and having fun. He doesn't want to intrude. Meeting a girl at a bar is not as easy as it sounds, and he can't stand the swiping game on dating apps. The bartender approaches Mark and catches him looking at the whiskey shelf. "Why don't you treat yourself to something nice?" he says, and reaches for a 14-year-old single malt. "I might as well," Mark answers, and goes back to his thoughts. This wasn't the plan at all. He never thought he'd end up alone. After graduating, he had joined the family company and totally immersed himself in work. The long hours and frequent traveling to customers made time fly by, but he was lonely. He kept putting off his plans to see the world. It was just never the right timing to take time off from work. He didn't even get the business degree he desired, and now it looked like all this effort was not going to pay off. He wouldn't become the head of the family company, simply because there wouldn't be a family company. Mark takes another sip of his whiskey and feels the smooth fire going down his throat. He is not going to give up. He'll find a way to change his father's mind. But then what? As much as he hates to admit it, his father may have a point. "You're not a quitter," Mark says to himself, and looks up. The bartender puts nice-looking appetizers in front of the couple sitting on his left. He will stay with the company and do his best, but he needs to start thinking of himself as well. "Why don't you treat yourself to something nice?" he is thinking. "Why not?" The dream of hiking across Australia will have to be put off for obvious reasons, but maybe it's time to get his MBA. He has been thinking about that for a while now. He can go to the local university so he won't need to leave town. They have weekend classes every other week, so it won't interfere much with work. That means he'll sign up for the executive MBA program. He likes the sound of that. The company will pay for it. His father owes him at least that. "I'll take another one," he says to the bartender. "I'm treating myself to something nice." 4. Undesirable effects in multi-project environments. September arrives, and the academic year begins. Rick enters the classroom and puts his leather bag on the professor's desk. The Rules of Flow course in the Executive MBA program is his favorite. Since he started teaching this course over 10 years ago, he has gotten a lot of experience in the field, and the material has developed quite a bit, but the first lecture has remained the same. He looks around. About 20 students are in the room, and as usual, the front row is empty. Everybody is quiet, except for a small group in the back that is too busy talking to notice he is about to start. "My name is Professor Richard Silver, and you are?" Rick attempts to grab the attention of the woman who is talking in the back. She has big glasses and thick black hair tied in a ponytail.
"Kiara Srini?"
She turns to Rick and sits down.
"Sorry about that,"
she apologizes. "Do you happen to work in a multi-project environment?" Rick asks her. The students better realize from the get-go that his teaching style is different.
"You could say that."
She smiles and gestures to the other two in her group.
"We work for the IT division of a bank."
She goes on as if she's used to explaining.
"Our division develops and maintains all the bank's information technology needs, everything the bank employees and customers do online."
"Perfect," Rick says. IT departments have a lot of room for improvement. Good that she brought reinforcements. He turns to the rest of the class. "Who else operates in a multi-project environment?" The room is quiet. Rick looks around. No one volunteers. Finally, an elegant woman with perfect makeup and not a hair out of place, the only person sitting in the second row, asks,
"Can you explain what you mean by multi-project?"
"Sure."
Rick is glad she asked.
And you are?
Shonda James.
Knowing that the academic definitions won't be very helpful, Rick opts to reply with a question. Are you involved in more than one project that share common resources?
I believe so, she answers.
I'm in marketing. My department is responsible for launching all the campaigns for my company's new products.
Excellent.
I'm Ted, and I'm the general manager of a construction company, says a freckled redhead in the corner. We work on several projects in parallel, and we juggle some resources between them.
Someone makes a sarcastic remark about contractors and juggling that Rick chooses to ignore.
Definitely multi-project. Who else?
Soon it becomes apparent that pretty much everyone in the class is involved in one way or another with multiple projects. Kiara and her colleagues from IT, Ted in construction, Shonda in marketing, Mark, who runs the engineering department in his family company, and a group of rather young guys in plaid flannel shirts who work at a nearby software company. Rick is familiar with the amazing salaries and perks young programmers get these days. These guys probably got the MBA program as a bonus or something.
Good, Rick says to himself. That variety is going to make it interesting. We can start.
Rick grabs a marker from his bag and writes as high as he can on the whiteboard. Undesirable effects in project management. He could have written things that annoy you on a regular basis, but he needs to sound academic. He turns back to the class.
Kiara, will you please share with us what the heated discussion earlier was about?
The group was rather loud, and Rick had overheard enough to figure it was work-related. Kiara's colleague, who sits on her left, answers,
We've got this issue we've been struggling with for a while now, and Kiara's people could probably figure it out in a week, but she said they don't have time to help us.
Kiara explains in an apologetic tone,
My unit designed the infrastructure for the current version, so it's easier for us to figure these things out. I am trying to help everyone as much as I can, but my people are pulled in so many directions that we hardly have enough time to work on our own assignments.
The man on her right comes to her defense.
One of Kiara's people was helping us last month, and he was constantly interrupted by other urgent matters. He kept going back and forth between us and other teams, so what we thought would take him a few days to fix ended up taking 3 weeks.
Leaving your people hanging while they waited to get the issue resolved?
Rick wants to make a point.
Are you kidding? With the current workload, we're all going back and forth between tasks. They worked on other stuff, but this issue was urgent.
Rick says aloud as he is writing on the whiteboard,
People are forced into bad multitasking.
Everyone nods in agreement.
Thanks for sharing, he says to the group in the back. Who else has issues that interfere with running their projects smoothly?
Charlie, one of the youngsters in the plaid shirt, calls.
Rework! We get a piece of software nearly done, and then they change the specs, and we have to start all over again.
Charlie's friends offer several examples. All Rick gets is they have a few enemies who keep changing the specifications. Rick writes, There is too much rework on the whiteboard. Ted, the construction guy, calls from the corner.
We actually don't mind when the customers ask for changes. That means we get to charge them more.
No one appreciates his remark, so he continues.
What we can't stand is the need for approvals. We get going, the people, machinery, and materials are on site, and then we have to wait for inspections and permits. Work just comes to a halt.
Rick smiles. This one always comes up in the top three complaints. He writes in general terms.
Too often work comes to a halt because relatively small things, approvals, people, materials, are missing.
I have another one. Shonda raises her hand. Too much time is spent on status reports.
I know exactly what you're talking about, Kiara says. We have to be in so many meetings to follow up on where people stand and how we are doing with the budget, etc., that sometimes it feels like we don't have enough time to work.
Rick writes, Too much time is spent on status reports on the whiteboard.
The discussion moves.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?